Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. A beautiful fall day in Louisville, Kentucky. I hope it is where you are as well. Let me tell you what we're going to be talking about today. The aftermath of the election, especially on Proposition 8 in California, has been extremely instructive. Not so much talking about the presidential election, but about Proposition 8. That was the action taken by the voters of California to define marriage in their state constitution as the union of a man and a woman, and only as a union of a man and a woman. Massive protests still going on right now, even in cities like Los Angeles and even in Salt Lake City. We're talking about why. We're also going to be talking about what it means to gauge the aftermath of this. Some fascinating stuff. I think you're going to be really interested to hear some of the comments being made by some recognizable names. And what is happening is exactly what many of us were certain would happen. And that is that the issue is now getting even more tightly and clearly defined. And when the pressure is on, some things come out that are very revealing. We're going to be talking about that in just a moment. And we're going to be asking the question, what do these things mean? The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We'll be talking about many things this week. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. And there is plenty for us to talk about. USA Today, cover story. It's in the Life section, Section D of USA Today. Today headline, waiting for the right time. The median age at first marriage hits peak, 26 years old for women and 28 for men. That is roughly half a year above where it was for the 2000 census. I've written a lot about this, talked a lot about this. I have tremendous concerns about what this means in terms of delayed adulthood, extended adolescence. I think it tells us a great deal about America. We're going to be looking at this, and this is going to be our show on Friday. We're going to be taking this on. I'll be writing about it this week at albertmohler.com, and we'll have the opportunity to talk about it in coming days. You might want to look at that article at USA Today. Fascinating stuff, but just consider this. What a shift it means for human beings to be marrying so much later. For instance, in 1950, the average age for first marriage for men was 22.8. That's 22.8. And for women, 20.3. So the average 20-year-old woman was getting married just 50 years ago or so. And now it's way out there. 6 more years for women, 8 more years for men. And those are not years that are being invested in many of the things that adults have traditionally done. Rather, it's more of an extended adolescence. We'll be talking about that again. You can look at the article at USA Today. A lot of good conversation coming on that one. Other big issues in the news, of course, the Christmas season is underway. Economic news is out there that's pretty daunting, and that is going to affect toy manufacturers as well. New York Times reporting that this may be a blue Christmas for toy makers. Here's what it says. The National Retail Federation predicts holiday sales will rise just 2.2% from last year, but it looks like that many of the things that are cut are going to be toys. Quote, we're going to see revenue flat or slightly up, but you may see a decline in units sold. That's, by the way, an expert in the toy business known as the toy guy, Chris Byrne. Now, I am raising this today not because I'm so concerned about the toy economy, but because I'm amazed at what they're talking about here. The news story caught my attention by the headline, but it's some of the content within it that I think the reporter didn't even find all that shocking, that I find shocking. For instance, I can remember as a kid thinking about toys. You know, how much would a toy cost? You think about toys today. How much should a toy cost? So you're looking here at things such as Elmo Live, $60. Xbox 360, you're looking at $199 to $249. You got all kinds of interesting things here. You've got a life-size Barbie dress, $20, but you have to buy the Barbie doll first. It really is interesting. You start looking at this. One of the things in this story is that there is going to be a resurgence of $10 toys. Walmart has launched a price war last month with 10 top toys at $10. These include Barbie, Hot Wheels cars, different kinds of items. You know, I think that's going to be very, very interesting. You know what? $10 sounds to me like a more appropriate cost for a toy in terms of its lasting value and all the rest. The other issue with many of these toys is what kind of social message they're bringing. And we'll be looking at that on this program in coming days, too. A lot of parents out there wondering about what to buy for Christmas. Well, remember that toys are not morally neutral in many cases. Now, a Slinky, that's pretty morally neutral. Tinker Toys, that works. But you can look at a lot of these other toys, and they come with a message. And we're going to be talking about that as well. President-elect Barack Obama made his first ever visit to the Oval Office today. Met with President George W. Bush. Very interesting meeting, filled with historical import. Two big firsts here. It was the first time the president-elect had ever stepped into the Oval Office. That's somewhat surprising, because generally, leaders in Congress, there's a cycling through of senators and congressmen and other officials in Washington to come for official opportunities, photo opportunities, and all the rest. It's another reminder that Barack Obama has not been in Washington long enough to have had a ceremonial reason to be in the Oval Office. But when he goes into the Oval Office next, he will go in as the incumbent president of the United States on January the 20th, 2009. You know that it had to be a very significant day, because the second first was that it was the first time that these two men had actually met each other. The first time that President George W. Bush and Barack Obama, Senator Obama, now President-elect Obama, had met face-to-face. And that had to be interesting. Of course, they met also with their wives. Interesting footage right now that I'm seeing on the screen of the president and the president-elect walking outside the West Wing near the Rose Garden. A lot of things going on there. And just in case anyone wondered about some of those things going on, all you have to do is look at today's newspaper. Big stories out indicating that President-elect Obama is intending to use the executive power of the presidency to reverse many of the executive orders set down by President George W. Bush. The Wall Street Journal headline, Obama is likely to use executive power to halt drilling, fund stem cell research. This is another reminder to us of the power of the presidency. This is one of the issues that was at stake that voters should have had in mind, and perhaps did have in mind, many of them, in going to the ballot, because what this means is that with a simple stroke of the pen, many things can be reversed from one administration to the next. This is the power of the executive authority of the president. President George W. Bush, back in 2001, in fact, it was shortly before 9/11, signed into policy of the United States a restriction on the number of human embryonic stem cell lines that can be used in federally funded research. That was a big decision. It's been a sticking point for the proponents of embryonic stem cell research ever since. And Rahm Emanuel, in an interview with the media, and in this case, it was even more so Mr. Podesta, John Podesta, the head of Mr. Obama's transition team, he said on Fox News Sunday that he described Obama as, quote, a transformational figure, end quote. And he said he's going to be rolling back executive orders issued by the Bush administration that would give, he said, Mr. Obama a fast way to put his mark on policymaking after he takes office. Now, let me just share with you a personal story about that. It was back in 1993. On January the 20th of 1993, I was in Washington, D.C., when President William Jefferson Clinton took the oath of office for his first term. I was not there for that reason. I was there because it was the 20th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. I was taking part in the ceremonies and observances there in Washington, D.C., commemorating in a very sad and tragic way the 20th anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision legalizing abortion on demand. I was also there for a meeting of some people looking at the culture in the future over the next several days. But I will never forget what it was like to be in Washington, D.C. on that day, because on that day, President William Clinton signed into law by executive order a reversal of so many. There, in particular, as I recall, there were five specific pro-life policies that had been put in place by the Reagan and first Bush administrations that President Clinton just eliminated and reversed, nullified, within moments of entering the Oval Office for the first time as president. They had all been prepared. All that was needed was a signature. And when he signed it, I'll just never forget hearing the news that day and realizing I'm standing at ground zero this day. That's back in 1993, standing at ground zero while history changes on these issues. The American presidency is invested by constitutional authority and now by statutory authority with all kinds of executive authority in these issues. And when it comes to the determination of these policies, you're going to see vast changes made. You're going to see some lightning moves made. Now, at the political level, this makes a lot of sense. You have a president-elect. He wants to make a big splash. But unfortunately, this was going to come particularly at the cost of human dignity, because sacrificing human embryos for medical research is just on a continuum of sacrificing human dignity for any kind of cause or purpose. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the issue of human dignity as it comes to the institution of marriage. We're going to talk about the response, especially of those who are pushing for same-sex marriage, to the decision by the voters of California to sustain marriage as a man and a woman. We're going to talk about some of the legal challenges coming up. We're going to talk about some of the religious liberty challenges coming up. But we're really going to be taking a look at some of the statements made in the last 72 hours that should open our eyes to what we're really up against on this. And we'll try to figure out together what these things mean. Give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK, coast to coast and with listeners around the world. You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. Proposition 8 passed in the state of California, and it passed not by a razor-thin margin, as been reported in some media, but by a rather significant margin. It's really 52-48. And if you look at the website for the Los Angeles Times, you can see some very interesting maps, because the maps really indicate where there were concentrations of votes for and against. And basically, green is the color that was on the website for the color that was for Proposition 8. That's for traditional marriage, and it's almost the entire state. And certainly the central San Joaquin Valley, Orange County, very conservative areas in California. The areas that were most insistent on defeating Proposition 8, you're basically limited to L.A. County, it appeared. And then to, of course, the whole area of the Bay Area of San Francisco and Palo Alto, Oakland, that whole area, very liberal, also Tiburon and Marin County. You're looking at a whole lot of distinction within the people of California there, geographically described. But in the aftermath of the passage of Proposition 8, we've heard some amazing things. The Los Angeles Times, out today, listen to this. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger said yesterday that the California Supreme Court should overturn Proposition 8, the ballot initiative that outlawed same-sex marriage. He also predicted that the 18,000 gay and lesbian couples have already wed would not see their marriages nullified by the initiative. It's unfortunate, he said, obviously, but it's not the end. I think that we will again maybe undo that if the court is willing to do that and then move forward from there and again lead in that area, end quote. Now, what do we need to note by that? He had more to say, but this much we know. Arnold Schwarzenegger is either a colossal moral hypocrite or completely befuddled and confused. And I don't believe he's confused. And I'll tell you why. He has run as if he is opposed to same-sex marriage. He says he's opposed to same-sex marriage. Then when same-sex marriage is reversed, he comes out and laments it, comes out and tells the supporters that they ought not to give up but to continue their struggle. Then at the end of this story in the LA Times, the governor says that he believes this is just like interracial marriage. He comes out and says it's the same thing. He publicly opposed Proposition 8, and he says that they should never give up. He said, I would tell them the same thing that I learned as a bodybuilder, trying to lift weights that were too heavy. I learned that you should never, ever give up, he says. They should never give up. They should be on it until they get it done, end quote. Very, very interesting there. So one of the things the people of California better learn is that they already knew that Governor Schwarzenegger was opposed to Proposition 8. Now he comes out, and he calls upon the Supreme Court to overturn it. And remember, this is a constitutional amendment. The people of California spoke 5 years ago, a little bit more than that, 2002, 7 years ago, spoke in Proposition 22 overwhelmingly to declare marriage as the union of a man and a woman, and only as the union of a man and a woman. In May of this year, 2008, the California Supreme Court usurped that authority from the people, declared same-sex marriage to be absolutely legal, to be mandatory within the state in terms of its recognition, and opened the floodgates. The voter response was to put this before the people, as the people of California have their own proposition referendum system. The people of California spoke, and now there are lawsuits to get the Supreme Court, to whom the voters were addressing this message, to reject it. Now, I'm not a prophet nor the son of a prophet, but I'll tell you this. If that state Supreme Court arrogates to itself the authority here to deny the people what the people have said to that court, you're going to see the delegitimization of the entire legal system in California, and in short order. But this tells you a whole lot about Governor Schwarzenegger as well. Let me just read to you one other here, because sometimes you just read things and you think, she didn't say that. You know, it can't be that obvious, but she did. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi expressed deep disappointment this past Friday that California voters approved Proposition 8. Now, this is what she said. Here is just a monument to political condescension. Listen to what the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Representative Nancy Pelosi, listen to what she says about the people of her state who voted to support Proposition 8. I'm reading here. Unfortunately, she said, I think people thought they were making a statement about what their view of same-sex marriage was. I don't know if it was clear that this meant that we are amending the Constitution to diminish freedom in our state, end quote. So in other words, she accuses the people of California of being too stupid to face the question and vote in a knowledgeable way. It'll be very interesting to see where this goes. She defended San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom for his actions that have basically now been shown to have been illegal in trying to push same-sex marriage within the city of San Francisco. It'll be very interesting to see what goes on here. But, you know, I have to tell you, and this is bipartisan. Governor Schwarzenegger is a Republican. Representative Pelosi is a Democrat. But on both counts here, we have really ludicrous positions on this issue. The phone number to join this conversation is 877-893-8255. In the background of this conversation, you also need to know that there have been major protests throughout California and now spreading into other states, including Utah. You had major boycott calls for Utah on the part of same-sex marriage advocates because of the support of the Mormon Church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, as it calls itself legally. In terms of Mormon support in California, it was huge. The single largest contributor to the financial support for Proposition 8 was the Mormon Church. And this is not unknown. And I have to tell you, this is one of those cases in which evangelical Christians can work with others of goodwill towards a public policy. And I'm one who's going to say right now, I'm glad the Mormons are on the right side of this question. And they're going to be facing a great deal of adversity here. And don't think it will stop with the Mormons. It's not. Just ask the folks at Saddleback Community Church. They're south of Los Angeles because they also had a large boycott call and protesters there on their property or just across the street from their property on Sunday. And you're going to see this spreading place to place. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. What do these things say to you? Let's go to Dan, listening on XM170, calling from Fayetteville, North Carolina. What do you say, Dan?
Hi, yes. I also have one additional comment after my, just based on what you had just said. But my original comment is that I found it very encouraging as seeing that people, even a large significant group of those who vote for the prevailing candidate, were still values voters who voted for a correct traditional morality.
Yeah, on marriage especially, yes.
My additional comment is I'm confused about Governor Schwarzenegger. After the night proposition, I believe he said something to the effect of the people of the state of California have spoken. It's time for people to respect that decision. And now he comes out, 6 years later, and the people of California have spoken, saying the exact same thing. And he comes out with the exact opposite message. I'm confused, Governor Schwarzenegger. What are you saying?
You know, Dan, I appreciate your call, and I tell you, I think you're a clear-headed man who isn't trying to play a political game, and that's why you recognize what's going on here. You know, this is the old formula, that was then, this is now. And I think that's the very reason why I raised this whole issue. It's very disappointing, but you know, we did a show on this a long time ago, back when Governor Schwarzenegger was running for office the first time after the recall of Governor Gray Davis. We were raising the question about voting for Arnold Schwarzenegger as a Christian moral question, simply because of his stance on these moral issues. He said then, by the way, that even he was pro-gay rights and pro-abortion and pro-choice, etc., he insisted that he was not in favor of same-sex marriage. But again, that was then, this is now. And what amazes me, Dan, is that he's not even attempting to harmonize this. So far as I can tell, he doesn't even recognize any cognitive dissonance here. That will only come to his attention if the voters of California make their concern there very, very clear. We're going to be back to talk about what is happening in some of these protests outside churches, but right now is your opportunity to call. Give me a call at 877-893-8255. Coast to coast, give me a call at 877-893-TALK. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. This whole issue is being discussed coast to coast and watched internationally because California's a watershed. Let me just give you a couple of data points here to keep in mind. You're looking at well over 20 states now that have adopted constitutional amendments or the equivalent to dictate, set down into law, that marriage is and exclusively is the union of a man and a woman. So you're looking at a massive populist movement here. You take those states, they already comprise states that include more than a bare majority of the American population. You're talking about a pretty big segment of the American population here. Then you start looking at a couple of other issues. You know, when Dan called in, he said he was really glad there was this moral fiber still left, this moral instinct still left to preserve marriage. Let me tell you about a couple of ways that kind of plays out. Number one, there was an increased Hispanic and an increased African-American vote, probably both driven by support for Senator Barack Obama as he was running for president. Well, here's the reality. Polling will demonstrate, and the election itself ended up demonstrating, that those two populations tend to support traditional marriage. In particular, Hispanic, Latino voters are going to support traditional marriage. African-American voters are going to be very opposed to same-sex marriage as a rule. And so what really happened is that Senator Obama ended up having coattails of a sort that helped Proposition 8, something that people may not have recognized. In the state of Florida, you had a similar proposition that passed by a much larger majority. In California, all they had to have is 50% plus one to amend the Constitution. In Florida, it required a 60% vote. The proposition got 62%. Now, you look at that 62%, an awful lot of that support came from the I-4 corridor between, say, Tampa and Duval County in Florida. You just draw a line from the southwest to the northeast, there in the central part of the peninsula, and you start looking at that. There was a massive resurgence of Hispanic voters in that area. As a matter of fact, just to take the county of Osceola County and the another county, Orange County, you're looking at far larger Hispanic votes than ever before. And at the same time, there was a real vote tally. Tallied up in support of the effort to define marriage as the union of a man and a woman. Now, let me just share with you a little historical point from a worldwide analysis. I was talking to one of the keenest observers of these things worldwide, who is very much looking at Europe and looking at immigration patterns in Europe and how that is diminishing the Christian heritage there. You have all these people coming from Pakistan and Turkey and other places that are coming in with an Islamic worldview that is really changing that landscape. On the other hand, immigration patterns in the United States tend to be coming from places, by and large, where there is a very clearly Christian formation to the culture, especially when it comes to an issue of marriage, where in Hispanic cultures, Central American and South American cultures, Mexican culture, there may be a better understanding of what marriage is traditionally than we found, say, per capita in the United States. So that's something just to put into the factor box here. When you start thinking about this, the immigration pattern probably helped. The resurgent Hispanic, Latino, and African-American votes probably helped in terms of passing these measures in Arizona, Florida, and California. And, you know, it just reminds me of the old saying, the Lord works in mysterious ways, his wonders to behold. So there are some interesting data points that came together here. You know, every election is a thing unto itself. If you ask the same question at a later time, you're going to get a different snapshot of the electorate because every election comes with so many factors going into it. And for instance, in this case, I think the misbehavior of those who were pressing the effort to defeat Proposition 8 also helped it. Sometimes that's just the way these things work. The phone number to join this conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Brenda, listening on XM170, calling from Alexandria, Minnesota. What are you thinking, Brenda?
Yes, Dr. Mohler, I was wondering if same-sex marriage becomes legal, does that mean that churches will be forced to perform the ceremony?
You know, the answer that is almost overwhelmingly given, Brenda, by any proponent of same-sex marriage or by people who oppose as legal experts is no. They'll say emphatically, no church will be forced to perform these marriages. Let me tell you the problem with that. Number one, I don't believe it. Now, I don't believe that there's ever going to be an officer of the court show up and say to a church, you must perform this same-sex marriage. I don't think that's it. But we're going to be talking on this program about the other levers of of influence and coercion that can come here. What if they say, look, if you want to keep your tax-exempt status, if you want to be considered a part of this community, you're going to have to support and recognize same-sex marriage. If you don't do that, then we're going to treat you like racists. We'll take away your tax exemption. That's going to be costly. And it will also put you at the back of the line. You want a building permit. You want to buy property. You want to get a building approved. You want to run a daycare center. You want to adopt children. We're going to treat you like you deserve to be treated. That's, I think, where it's going to come, Brenda. And there's good reason to believe that's so, because people pushing that agenda in legal circles have already begun making those arguments. We're going to be looking at that in coming days as well. To join the conversation, give me a call at 877-893-TALK on the Albert Miller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Moeller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. To join the conversation about the impact of all these things and the fallout from the victory of Proposition 8 in California, give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Long Island, New York. Krista's listening on XM170. Go ahead, Krista.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to say, why don't we just change the law, make it, instead of marriage, make it say civil union, and just have the churches deal with marriage, and that way, you know, everybody can be happy. And as far as with children, just, you know, just to make sure that civil union doesn't go too far, just, you know, make sure that it says that they have to be, have two parents, and you can't have three or four or five or whatever.
Very interesting argument, Krista. You know, in some places, that's exactly like I think of certain states that have adopted civil union statutes. In your state, New York, you have neither civil unions nor same-sex marriage as of yet, although your governor, David Patterson, has instructed state authorities to recognize both civil unions and same-sex ceremonies that have been conducted elsewhere. Krista, let me just try to understand your argument. You're saying let the state get out of the marriage business and let the state just create something called a civil union with the rights of marriage and leave marriage to the church. Is that fair?
Yes, and then the federal would have to change it too. Would have to change it so that the rights of marriage also go to people with civil unions, the survivors' benefits, et cetera, et cetera. Insurance.
And you're happy for that to happen, so you would make no distinction. You would want the law to make no distinction between a heterosexual union and a homosexual union.
You got it. It's civil union. Let the churches deal with marriage. And that way everybody can be happy and, you know, let people live and love as they want.
Okay, Krista, I appreciate your call. And I'll tell you, there is a logic, very clear logic, to what Krista's saying here. It's a logic that I think you've got some people working at on this issue. You can pretty clearly see it state by state and perhaps even at the federal level, some initiative. I'll tell you, Krista, why I would be opposed to that. And I appreciate you're very articulate in making the case. I'd be opposed to that, not saying that it wouldn't be better than some other arrangements. I'll concede that. That would be better than having same-sex marriage made legal and thus having marriage completely redefined before our eyes, which I think would be a colossal tragedy. I am not willing to see the logic, though, of having same-sex couples and heterosexual couples recognized as being the same when they're fundamentally not. I mean, you start talking about the state having, the entire culture having a very legitimate interest especially understanding the unique status of the reproductive capacity of heterosexual marriage, of the historic nature and status of homosexual couplings, and of the responsibility of children, of the society to believe that children really do need a father and a mother. If we don't believe that, then civil unions make a lot of sense, Krista. I'll be right up front. If we don't believe that children need both a father and a mother, then civil unions probably make sense. I'll tell you, though, from the other side, the other opposition to that isn't going to come from conservatives. It's going to come from the proponents of same-sex marriage, and they're going to claim it as a dignity and identity issue. And that's exactly the way they've been arguing it. They're saying, look, marriage is a status issue. It is a dignity issue. And to deny us that is to deny our dignity. Krista, I'll tell you, I would rather have what you're suggesting by far than to have the state corrupt the definition of marriage. It'll be interesting to see. It may be that we are going to be moving towards some kind of cultural consensus in which an option like what Krista suggested may be adopted by more and more people, perhaps who just get fatigued at even trying to figure all this out and say, let's make a clear distinction. let's let the churches have marriage, let's have the state have civil unions. That's not altogether different than what it's been in communism for many years, where you have had atheistic regimes, in particular in the former Soviet Union and, for instance, right now in Cuba and other places like that. I know a couple of friends of mine who were married in Poland. They had to have a separate church marriage and then a civil ceremony just to get it registered. And so there's been that kind of two-tier marriage, you know. That's why the people on the left don't like it, is because you can't have marriage or civil unions and civil unions plus, and they say that that violates their dignity. So it'd be very interesting to see how that goes. I think it violates the entire dignity of humanity to have marriage discounted. Thanks for your call, Krista. Always glad to hear from folks with a different point of view, and glad to hear from you in Long Island, New York. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. You could be next. I'd love to hear what you think. You know, I'm really, really interested. I'm a native of Florida. I grew up in Florida. Florida's been through so many transformations. This is a state with a fairly small population back in the 1950s when I was born that is now one of the largest states in the Union. Just look at the change on the electoral map and look at how Florida's population has mushroomed. Florida has changed a great deal. It was really a southern state years ago and then developed the Gold Coast with a lot of folks moving from the Northeast and the upper Midwest. And now you start looking at Florida, and it is a very cosmopolitan state. It's a state that has been transformed virtually all the way up the peninsula and well into the panhandle. And I was born in Polk County and then went to high school in Broward County. You start looking at this. Those are two different worlds back then. I don't think they're really so much two different worlds anymore. I think Florida has become a fascinating laboratory. Well, if same-sex marriage in a cosmopolitan state like Florida is turned down by 62% of the people who are willing to go to the polls and vote for a constitutional amendment to prevent it, that tells you something. You better tell the court something. And just to quote someone who was a proponent of same-sex marriage, if you can't get it through in California, you can't get it through nationwide. There's just no way. You're looking at a state that represents like 12% of the American population. You are looking at a huge political impact from the state of California, the most populous state, the state that is filled with the cultural creatives that shape so much of the culture. And they went all out for this. Interesting news coverage just before the election. Hollywood went all out in support of Proposition 8. They were having fundraisers and huge events, and it didn't work. It just didn't work. And the amazing thing is that you start looking at the money that was spent by those who tried to defend and, excuse me, to defeat Proposition 8. They spent millions and millions and millions. And you know a lot of those people are saying, hey, it really wasn't worth it. It went through anyway. You know, one of the take-home lessons, I think, from all of this had better be learned in the courts. And I'll go back to what I said last week. When the Roe v. Wade decision came out in 1973, the U.S. Supreme Court acted having nothing like what the courts have now. And that is state after state after state voting on the issue directly with citizen voice. I have to believe that Roe v. Wade wouldn't have come down the way it did had that reality been the case in the years preceding 1973. But it's that way now on this issue. Any court that wants to take this issue now is going to know that the people have spoken again and again and again and again. And unless they want to completely delegitimate their court, they better look at what the American people are saying. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program's Final Thoughts. We had a caller call up to say, how constitutional is it for states even to vote on these questions or to address them in constitutional amendments? What about the federal constitution? The federal constitution really assumes a principle of federalism, which means that these issues, unless otherwise addressed and enumerated by powers that are addressed in the federal constitution, belong to the states. And marriage has, from 1776 in the American Revolution and 1789 in the ratification of the constitution, been considered a state issue. And the only thing that has basically been addressed by the government, you have a couple of things. Of course, you did have the U.S. Supreme Court come along and say that laws against miscegenation, as it was then known, or interracial marriage were unconstitutional. So it wasn't, though, because the Constitution addressed marriage. It was because the Constitution addressed citizenship. And that's the way it evolved in terms of that legal decision. And then, of course, you have in the last decade or more, just a little bit more than a decade, the passage of DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, in which the federal government made a statement by adopting a law. That law, by the way, was understood to have relations to the Interstate Commerce Clause of the Constitution, to say that it does not violate the Constitution for a state to refuse to recognize a same-sex marriage performed in another state. That's what DOMA, or the Defense of Marriage Act, is. So beyond that, the federal government really doesn't have marriage laws. It does have to deal with marriage, though. It deals with marriage and taxation. It deals with marriage in terms of immigration and relationships. It deals with marriage in terms of inheritance and other issues. It just leaves to the states, or we should say historically, has left to the states the definition of what a marriage is. And basically, this is uncontroversial in American history. This wasn't something that was a matter of great controversy in American history until now. You basically did not have to worry years ago that a marriage would be recognized one place or the other. Or if it were a question, it was over the age of the persons involved or something like that, or the agent performing the marriage. This is something completely different. Now there is an attempted redefinition of marriage itself, and how different could it be? Well, right now, for instance, in the state of Massachusetts, you can have same-sex marriage, and in the state of Vermont as well. So you're really looking at having marriage that is redefined. But the state of Florida, the state of Arizona, the state of Utah, the state of California, you name the state, they do not have to recognize same-sex marriages performed elsewhere, and that's because of DOMA. President Barack Obama, President-elect Barack Obama, has indicated that he wants to see DOMA reversed. Perhaps today's conversation helps us to understand just how expensive that would be in terms of the cost to our society and to the institution of marriage. I appreciate good callers. Always glad to hear from people with a different point of view. Give me a call anytime. Join the conversation at 877-893-8255. Write me at albertroller.com and join me tomorrow. I'll see you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.